ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Don't have enough time to stay across all the latest news? ABC News Top Stories podcast explains the biggest breaking news stories and why they matter in less than 2 minutes. So you can hit play and get updated while brushing your teeth or making your lunch. And it's always up to date, ready whenever you're ready to get across the day's news. Just search ABC News Top Stories podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The National Party has a new leader. Conservative Queensland Senator Matt Canavan won the party leadership ballot, with Victorian MP, who's more moderate, Darren Chester, elected as his deputy. The new leader says to revive our nation, we need to go hyper-Australian and stop looking overseas for solutions. Matt Canavan's election comes after David Littleproud's shock exit from the role, with the Maranoa MP declaring he was buggered and had run out of steam. So what does this shake-up mean for the future direction of the regional party, and will they claw back votes from One Nation? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Claire Armstrong. And PK, I have a bone to pick with you.
Oh, no.
Yesterday on the podcast, you said what a busy day it had been. It couldn't possibly get any busier. And then at 3:30 in the afternoon, I found myself walking into the mural hall for the announcement of David Littleproud's resignation. Yeah. You jinxed us.
Oh, mate. Matt Canavan has won. We know that David Littleproud is buggered. I buggered up the podcast by making a claim that I now can't substantiate. Claire, you're right. Although I don't think it comes bigger than the Middle East.
No, that still is true.
but yes, the resignation of the Nationals leader yesterday, David Littleproud, came as what seemed like a shock. But I'm going to throw in to this discussion, and I bet, Claire, as a student and studier of everyday politics, you're going to actually agree with me. Not entirely a surprise. The timing and the way he did it, sure, absolute surprise. Flanked by his wife, talking about exhaustion. But I will put this to you.
There were signs.
Just a couple of weeks ago, did he not stand for the Nationals leadership? I want to ask you this, Claire. Was he not buggered a couple of weeks ago? Did the buggered just happen suddenly onset with buggered? Like, come on. He could see things were not going his way. There is a by-election on the horizon. He had said the Nationals might come last. That did him so much damage internally, saying that he'd lost the fight. He has been absolutely hammered internally. He jumped, in my view, because he knew he was losing support. What do you reckon?
I have to agree. I think there were some signs that his heart wasn't in it. There's a bit of chicken and egg there in terms of that loose language around essentially, well, we're going to come 3 from 3 out of the Conservative, you know, challenges in the Farah by-election being One Nation, the Liberals and the Nationals. That was incredibly politically stupid, because you're the leader. You have to turn around to donors and ask them to reach into their wallets. You've got to turn around to your membership and ask them to hand out on a Saturday. You've got to ask your candidate to give up 9 weeks of their life travelling a very vast electorate. And here you are from the off saying, well, it's all a bit hopeless. I think that was a huge sign of where his mind was at. But you're right. There, you know, he didn't take the opportunity to bow out when he was challenged. His excuse was he'd initially thought that he'd leave immediately after the coalition reunited the second time, but decided that he needed to sort of see that period of tumult through. Perhaps he had fancied who his successor, who he'd like him to be, and they weren't quite ready, who knows. But yes, there were certainly signs, I think, that he was, that this realisation was dawning on him. But, you know, he tried to paint himself as the altruistic, I bleed the party kind of line. But you'd think, given that even, you know, whoever was leader, the Nationals are not winning Farah, a lot would have to happen in the next 2 months for that to be a possibility. You'd think he'd kind of wear it, right? Like, he could have bowed out after the Farah loss and taken all of that baggage with him, and instead he's left it on the conveyor belt for Mr. Matt Canavan.
Oh, has he ever? Okay, so Matt Canavan is now the new leader of the Nationals. I would say he was widely tipped as perhaps not having the numbers, and then he walks out victorious. Again, I'm not surprised by that. I think the Nationals made a calculation that they needed a rival to One Nation, and the other dude that, and woman actually, that were putting their hands up, Kevin Hogan, who I think really is very much a moderate of the Nationals, and then Bridget McKenzie, who I don't think had enough friends really in the party room, clearly, weren't able to win. Matt Canavan was seen as someone who can talk to the people who are going to One Nation. Don't you reckon that's really ultimately the calculation they've made today?
That was certainly his pitch. There's a lot of despair inside the current membership of that Nationals party room about what their options were in terms of a leader, despair in some of the former members of that party room that I've been speaking to in the last sort of 12, 24 hours. We've got a whole new leader in less than 24 hours. But there was a view, I think, that formed the Queenslanders really swung in behind Matt Canavan. A number of things have happened. He's had quite a remarkable kind of parliamentary career. He, you know, rose through the ranks very quickly when the coalition were in government, a cabinet minister, fairly reasonably well-liked and effective. He was Northern Australia and Resources Minister for a lot of that time. Bowed out of the cabinet in order to back a challenge against then-leader Michael McCormack that was led by Barnaby Joyce. His stepping down, which is technically what you're supposed to do when you are a member of a cabinet, allowed Mr. McCormack to offer that place to someone else in the party, and he managed to hold on. And so then Canavan's on the backbench, and that's where he has remained for many years and developed more and more of a kind of maverick persona that would have, I think, made him quite unpalatable to a lot of his colleagues as a leader for a very long time. Bit of a shift in the last 6 months, though. Very close to Barnaby Joyce. He was a staffer to Barnaby back in the day, very much a mentor-mentee kind of relationship initially that then flipped. You know, Canavan kind of became the more senior, more mentory type person, really counselled Barnaby Joyce against jumping across to One Nation and was really quite affected by that happening. And I think his colleagues have subsequently seen a different side to him where, absolutely, he's crashed and crashed through on policies like ditching net zero. He led the charge in the Nats walking away from the hate laws earlier this year. But they saw a side of him, I think, that maybe they hadn't seen for a number of years, and that quelled some of the concerns that his colleagues might have had about what kind of a leader he could be.
I think that is absolutely bang on your analysis. So it brings me to the deputy, who is, of course, very different type of dude, Darren Chester, more of a moderate Victorian, for crying out loud, Gippsland, just a very different part of Australia.
I think everyone
accepts that. Excellent yoga, just a beautiful part of the country, actually, like one of my favourite places. How does that look? And how does that look with also the Liberals? Like, how do they do all that, Claire? Like, I'm not sure how that looks.
Well, you know, not to bring listeners behind the scenes, but we were just saying before we hit record that this might be good for the Nationals. It could be quite bad for the Liberals having a Matt Canavan-esque figure at the helm of the Nationals. Obviously, the presence of Darren Chester, very much a moderate, maybe balances some of that. It's not unusual to have sort of competing factional types within a leadership team. That's often how you end up exerting a bit of calm and control over your party room. But how it works remains to be seen. Because, for example, if Darren Chester pushes back on his leader as much as Canavan has historically pushed back on leaders who he is not politically aligned with, then that's going to cause quite a lot of friction. I don't think that that is how Chester will operate. But I do think he will hold his ground on a few key issues. I think he'll see himself as the sort of go-between a bit between the Liberals and the Nationals when there are these sort of coalition policy development conversations that have to take place. Canavan, in the press conference he just held after winning the ballot, was asked, you know, you have this reputation now as a maverick, you cross the floor, you really lead with your chin, and how are you going to maintain that if you're a leader? And he did acknowledge that he now plays a slightly different role as leader. But I think quite tellingly, he has been very consistently strong on not having any sympathy or empathy or any kind of real willingness to show understanding for the plight of the Liberals, who feel that they are never going to get back into government without a pathway to winning back some of those city seats, not even the inner city, just some city seats at this point. He hasn't really shown much sympathy to that plight, and I'm not sure that he's going to feel that it's his job as the leader of the Nationals to help facilitate that, even if it does relegate the coalition to opposition for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think this is now a really fascinating period, I think, for the coalition, how they bring this all together. I think it's fair to say that Matt Canavan has some really unexpected ideas on some things as well. A couple of examples I want to give you. One is the war. I mean, he is quite a purist on those sorts of things, like the idea of deploying troops far away, you know, almost in that, you know, this is my language, not his, I want to be very clear, but the sort of the MAGA movement style of, oh, we don't want to be part of faraway wars. He uses a lot of that same rhetoric, I think, for here. Mm-hmm. He's quite almost left wing when it comes to economics and intervention in our markets. I'm, of course, you know, spruiking my own Four Corners documentary, but he played a very leading and starring role. What good timing for me. It's there. It's called Realignment. Watch it, because he articulates how he sees politics, and it's a very kind of Australia first, that whole populist approach he really articulates. So that's his approach. That's what you will see from him, how that works within a wider Liberal Party. Whether they can actually keep that brand, the coalition brand, together is another question. And the other one you mentioned already, but I really think it's important, is free speech. On free speech, Matt Canavan is an absolute purist. He doesn't pick and choose. And for that, I think he should be given some credit. He doesn't just condemn things he doesn't like and then support things he likes. He's a purist about all speech, you know, with some limits, but you know what I mean? Isn't he clear? Like, he doesn't play the same politics as some right-wingers who've become almost the police chiefs of language.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that you picked up these threads in that reporting you did with Four Corners about this rise of economic populism, the return of an Andrew Hastie to the shadow cabinet for the Liberals and now Matt Canavan for the Nationals really bolsters that kind of argument. The commentary that Canavan was making, you know, he had some good zingers. It's not about left and right. Australians don't understand that. I'm here to do what's right for the country. And that it's stepping away from, you know, a conservative means XYZ on social issues, XYZ on the economy. Although, of course, we've kind of always had that agrarian socialist sort of angle and aspect of the Nationals Party. He is definitely on those issues you've outlined, you know, a conviction politician. And this comes back to the big pitch, which is how he differentiates and launches what he literally called a fight back, which is obviously about challenging One Nation, who are resurgent in the polls. You know, that's been canvassed ad nauseum. But a couple of things I found very interesting from Canavan just before. He really sought to highlight that Pauline Hanson has been in the parliament for twice as long as he has, and he can't point to a single hospital or bridge or anything else in their shared home state that she's delivered, whereas he, as a senator for the state, can. And he really identified, and I think this is going to be fascinating, he said he's worried about what he always disliked about the rise of identity politics, as he calls it, in the left, creeping into the right. And he returned without prompting to the comments made by Pauline Hanson a couple of weeks ago, inferring that there were effectively no good members of the Muslim community in Australia. And he outright rejected that and said that is absolutely antithetical to his perspective about what unites and divides Australia, that is not the way that he wants to frame politics and political debate in this country, even as he's saying, you know, build more here, have more Australian babies, bring back larrikinism, all of these kind of touchstones of that, you know, fringes of the identity politics of the right. But he was very clear in differentiating from Pauline Hanson. And I think, as you touched on, it'd be interesting to see if you think he can differentiate from Pauline Hanson. And will we see any result in Farah, or is it all a bit too gone for that?
Look, I think it's going to be pretty hard in Farah, and I think that's the legacy of David Littleproud. I mean, there's a lot of positive legacies they're talking up, but he's also dumped them in it at a very bad time without much forward thought. I mean, Bridget McKenzie was telling me they were in a planning meeting just the day before, and he didn't give them any indication that he was about to do this. So I don't know about Farah. I think it's going to be pretty hard on whether he can differentiate. I think in terms of regaining right-wing votes, their best chance is under Matt Canavan. He has the ability to take on Hanson and Joyce like none of the others do, while still keeping within some level of integrity around race, where he does stand up. Some people will find him to say things they don't like. I'm not saying you can't, but I do think he, you know, the Muslim stuff was a good one. He really came out strong and said, nah, that's ridiculous. And I think that's where the differentiation, but the in that plain speaking way he does, will be meaningful and is the best chance they have. However, whether that does them damage in the cities, in the metropolitan areas for Liberal seats, well, he's absolutely somebody who has, again, a long list of things he's said, which are absolutely at odds with a lot of views in metropolitan, you know, gentrified Australia, which could cause them trouble at a broader level, and that is the conundrum, right? So watch this space. It is a fascinating time, though, in politics, just to see the upheaval and the right of politics, because that's what we're seeing. This is seismic. All of the shifts we're seeing are because of the rise of the populist, right? One Nation, the shifts in the votes from Angus Taylor's election now to David Littleproud falling on his sword. It's all quite a big shift. And I think anyone who pretends that they know the outcome is lying. I think it's very in many ways, you can compare it to 20 years ago. You can compare it to lots of things. But we are in a very different world. Look what's happening in the Middle East, which is where I'm taking you now. Do you like how I did that? I'm taking you to a part of the Middle East. And of course, I'm talking about the Iranian soccer delegation. Tony Burke announcing another two members of that delegation have now been granted humanitarian visas. That makes them seven all up. He did a big press conference today. He articulated, I thought, really interesting detail about how the Australian government managed the last minute applications. It sounded to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but at face value as a pretty great version of how you do border protection, where each woman was taken separately to talk to our officers without the minders in a way, he said, which tried not to put any pressure on them, you know, no pushing them to come, no pushing them to go, just informing them that there would not be punishment for staying and that they were being offered protection if they choose to take it. And it ultimately led to two extra taking that opportunity. Others, of course, are now on their way. They've left. Claire, it is significant, but there are some contradictions in all of the policies, aren't there?
Yes. I mean, I think it's incredible that we actually have a lot of the detail of the process of this operation. And, you know, if there are any people working for Tony Burke out there listening, I would say as a journalist, keep it up, because I love this level of transparency and we should have it across the Home Affairs portfolio all the time, not just when it's good
it's
news.
It's a portfolio that I can I say know, does my head
But that's
head
why
in.
It is unusual. We don't normally get the kind of granular we've got, and it's fascinating to kind of see. And the few points that are obviously of note, I really appreciated how the minister framed this as being, we are the kind of country that gives people the choice to live how they want to live, that respects women, that says to them, we understand this is a really complicated decision. You have family members, presumably, who are still in Iran. Efforts were made to actually connect these women to whoever they wanted to talk to, whatever family members. There was a passing of phone numbers to Home Affairs officials that they could speak to these women and they could deliberate their futures in a way that, you know, as the minister was pointing out, is not available to them in their country of birth. I thought that was really great and a really good show of like where the system can work. Questions obviously naturally arise now about the visas, for example, being granted to the minders who came out here with the team. Tony Burke confirmed that not everyone in the Iranian delegation who applied to come with the team was granted it. There's been concerns raised by some sporting people and others that the competition itself, the Asia Cup, didn't conduct essentially a human rights risk assessment that they should have been able to foresee. this kind of an issue. I mean, obviously we didn't know that war was going to break out in the Middle East, but, you know, it's always a factor when you're hosting an international event like this with people coming from countries like Iran or North Korea or anywhere. I think on the one hand, it's been a fascinating kind of expose of how we can really do things right. Questions remain about whether we could have done more, whether the way that the situation was handled with the minders could have been any better. I'm reasonably satisfied with the answers that the government has given on all of those questions. But as we saw, I mean, I was up late last night watching the footage of protesters and activists concerned about these women sort of storming the international airport at Sydney, trying to, you know, prevent the team or show their support for the team. It's a very complicated and emotional issue. I think probably the outcome has been as good as it could be, acknowledging that these women had a really difficult decision to make about, you know, family members and other factors that we couldn't possibly understand really in their own personal lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, Claire, isn't it, where there is an absolute at the heart of this. I agree with you. When Tony Burke talked about this as the best of Australia, actually free choice, all of this, I thought, yeah, absolutely. And you kind of, you know, I hate to bore you with my nationalism, but I had a moment of like real pride of living in this country. But I think we should be truth tellers here. And I don't think Border Force does that with everyone seeking asylum to our country. And this is not what this free choice looks like for people who make it here. So I think that to me makes it a really complicated and difficult story. Equally, I feel elated for these women, right?
Absolutely. And it's worth noting that this has happened to come at the backdrop of the government rushing through legislation that would essentially allow a minister of the day like Tony Burke to suspend the type of temporary visa that a sports person might come to this country on, essentially on the basis that, to give a quick explanation, all different types of temporary visas, student, visitor, tourist, whatever you want, whatever have you, even skilled migrant, sometimes they're temporary. The government is rushing through legislation that would allow them to suspend for 6 months and then maybe again for another 6 months. A visa already granted, a student's already been told they can come here, or a tourist's already been told they can come here. If certain criteria are met that essentially change the situation and make it more likely, say if there's an outbreak of war or some other upheaval in that country, that when that person enters legitimately on a temporary visa, they might be inclined to attempt to use their presence here to stay. Now, Tony Burke has justified this by saying that it's about ensuring the government can be deliberate in how it handles its humanitarian program, that it wants to be able to be helping people, but not purely just the ones who happen to come here for other reasons and make the most of the timing. But in a way, what we've seen happen with this soccer team is they came here, war broke out, and they made a decision based on a change in circumstances. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm not sure how the government kind of reconciles those two things, but that is essentially what has happened in the space of the same day. They've implemented a way of essentially guaranteeing they don't necessarily have to do this in the future, even as they do it.
Yeah. Look, there is an inherent tension between those positions, and we have to call it for what it is. But equally, you know, in a utopia, you would have a perfect system where everyone is treated absolutely equally. But that is not the world we live in, and it's not the country we live in. And so let's be truthful about that. But in this case, I think I could see universally, with the exception, I don't know, of Hanson, as far as I can see, everyone being pretty happy that these women who live under nothing short of tyranny are able to just live happy lives and play sport, which is what they want to do in our country. And, you know, we quite like sport. So I was thinking maybe they could try AFLW.
Well, anyway, actually, some of the A-League clubs have put their hand up already and offered resource. And to be honest, the Women's A-League could use much attention and talent as possible. So I'm all here for it. I hope one of them comes to play for Canberra.
Totally. I'm like, I also have, like, can Sam Kerr call them? Can we get a phone call from Sam? You know what I mean? Can you imagine? Like some Insta video that goes. Anyway, I've got it all, like a beautiful vision in my head, because we're all looking for happy stories. And I think this is what this has delivered as well. A partly happy story, let's not be delusional. There's an unhappy part of this story too, and that's an ongoing war and a regime that is not falling, Claire, that is absolutely not falling. That's it for politics now for today. Tomorrow, Fran and I will be back for The Party Room. If you have a question for us, send us a short voice note to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. See you, Claire.
Thanks.